saying you.
Yes?
What's rolling?
I can't remember.
Hey, everybody. Nice to see everybody here. Give a wave to Jay. Welcome to the Gloucester Writers Center. Just going to tell you some of the events we have coming up, and then we're very happy to have Andre here, Andre Spears here, to introduce David Hurd. We have on Friday night our own version of the Moth Story Hour, Fish Tales, which will be at the Rocky Net Cultural Center at 7:30. And the theme this week of this month's Fish Tales is Our Town, Our Very Own Gloucester. Also, we will be awarding the Amari Baraka Scholarship that the Gloucester Writers Center gives out that night, so it'll be a special evening for at least one person.
And they're close friends. Yes.
Then Wednesday, July 25th, also at the Rocky Neck Cultural Center, we have Erica Funkhauser and Storm Stockman. That's a great reading we're looking forward to, and we've been looking forward to it since this horrible winter when it was originally scheduled. On Wednesday, August 1st, Ann Charters will be reading. And then on August 6th, the Open Mic, which is a great event here at the Writer Center, a generous audience and great readers. And this month, it will be hosted by Paul Coltrera, because I will be in the North Woods of New Hampshire. Paul says he's going to bring his accordion instead of the ukulele, which I usually use to strike fear in the hearts of the people. We have the Hetty Jones Memoir Workshop on August 10th and 11th. I've got to check on the enrollment there to see if it's filled up or not, and I'll get back.
We've got room for maybe one more.
All right. She's right here.
All right.
Then on Wednesday, August 15th, Iman Hillman. And August 22nd, Raymond Foy. And then in October, we have our annual Charles Olson Lecture, which will be Ed Sanders. That's going to be pretty exciting. If you haven't checked out the Maud Olson Library, it's currently open on Tuesday afternoons. It's a few doors down, and there will be new hours for that coming soon. And once they're announced, they will be in the blast. So keep your eyes open for more opportunities to get over there, sit at Olson's table, read the books he used, and look out over the harbor, or just be alone. maybe you guys don't all have small children. But without any more attempts at hilarity, I'm going to welcome Andre Spears up here. Very thankful to have you here tonight to introduce David Hurd.
I'm really pleased to welcome David Hurd at the Gloucester Writers Center. I first met David at the Centennial, the Olson Centennial at the University of Kent, where David teaches, and where I was introduced to him by Ralph Maud. Through a fortunate twist of fate, I actually ran into him again about 2 months ago in Paris, where he was reading in the larger context of a conference on cartography. A three-day conference in cartography. So that was good to see him again, especially since I knew he was coming here. At the time, someone introduced him as a poet, and it was a great introduction. So I took the lazy man's route, and I asked him to forward that introduction. And then, as it turns out, that was the same introduction as is on the website, on the Gloucester. So I was actually, I could have been even more lazy and waited, but, you know, so I did some, you know. Let me read that small intro that's on the website. David Hurd's collections of poetry include All Just, Konkane 2012, Out With, Book Thug 2012, through Konkane 2016. He has given readings and lectures in Australia, Belgium, Canada, France, Poland, the USA, and the UK, and his poems, essays, and reviews have been widely published in magazines, journals, and newspapers. He is the author of John Ashbery and American Poetry, Enthusiast, Essays on Modern American Literature, and the editor of Contemporary Olson. His recent writings on the politics of human movement have appeared in Detention Unlocked, Los Angeles Review of Books, Parallax, PN. What does PN stand for?
Ah, they're embarrassed about it. Poetry Nation, and then they stopped. They dropped that.
PN Review. Yeah. And the Time Literary Supplement. He is a co-organizer of the project Refugee Tales and professor of modern literature at the University of Kent, where I believe you teach basically English and American poetry, is that correct? Which is a great field. I want to say two things. The first is I highly recommend this anthology, edited by David, Contemporary Olson, for two reasons. All the work in this is of the highest quality, and it says something, again, about Olson's work. It invites extremely thorough and rigorous scholarly research and criticism. But what's most peculiar about it, what's unique about it, is that of the 25-some contributors, only three of them are American. And of the rest, I don't know, there's maybe one or two who aren't coming from English-speaking countries. Belgium, for example. But the vast majority of the contributors are writing in English from English-speaking environments, that is to say, Canada, Australia, and, of course, principally the UK. So there's a cultural difference at work that sort of supplements and enhances the critical distance of the outsider's perspective. More to the point, It underscores the history, the important history that Olson has with the UK and with British poetry. This is really well documented in an essay by Gavin Sullery from Weymouth Back, Olson's British Context, Travels, and Legacy. Olson was a strong influence, had it much more so than I realized, on a number of poets in the 60s, 70s, and after his death, Jeremy Prynne, Eileen Feinstein, Andrew Crozier, Tom Raworth, Alan Fisher, and of course Ian Sinclair. So it's something like of a feedback loop a little bit that this work and sort of the body of poetry behind it is coming back at us at this time. What someone has described in this anthology, the reaction, the English reaction to Olson, as less dramatic than the American reaction, and I think there's something to be said for that. That it's in a sense almost the lucidity is something that I think you would all appreciate. What I appreciate about David's work as a poet and a scholar is that he can read, he can write about, and he can admire the work of John Ashbery, and then move on to read, write about, and admire the work of Charles Olson. He doesn't feel compelled to choose sides. He doesn't feel that he has to work under the banner of one camp versus another. He sees in these poets resources that are for use, for himself and for others in the work that needs to get done. Foucault has the image, the metaphor of a toolbox, and I think that the same is here. Here's Olson, and this is the Olson tools, set of tools, and here, if it works for you, use these. These are the Ashbery tools. Deleuze has a similar, to convey the same notion, the metaphor in his work on Proust of colored glasses. He says, hey, look through these. This is the Ashbery effect. See if it works for you. And if it doesn't work for you here, try the Olson thing. There's a beautiful line in David's essay herein, The View from Gloucester and Open Field Poetics and the Politics of Movement, in which he reprises Miriam Nichols. He's commenting on Miriam Nichols' Radical Affection. She has an article in here where she says, picking up on Miriam. In fact, some question as to whether this thought is from Miriam or from David. But, but after Olson's death, criticism turned away from Olson. And then he says, writing didn't learn all it might have from him. And I love that statement. Writing, for all intents and purposes here, is a synonym for polis. A polis is this. This is Olson offers this for us, and David is offering, in his own work, in the work of the critics, he in his anthology and of all the body of poetry, English poetry primarily behind it, is bringing a new set of eyes to Polis. The internationalist perspective and the cultural sophistication of his work, I think, are crucial now in the age of, you know, Brexit and Trump, two disasters these countries share, the entrenched ethnocentricity, and at the same time, paradoxically, this schizoid sense of tribalism that, you know, Brexit and Trump represent, I think at some level can also be said to threaten the art of poetry, certainly in the United States and maybe in the world, the old world, new world, English-speaking world, or non-English-speaking world. Another thing I appreciate about his work is poetry in particular. I think it has, it's political poetry, but it's political poetry, the way in which he integrates his political vision to the poetry is innovative. I think we can all learn from it. It has a subtlety and an intellectual finesse that stands in contrast, that seems very foreign to much of what passes for political poetry in the United States. Specifically, he picks up on this notion of crossing. In Olson's day, back in the 60s and 70s, we could think of frontiers, we can think of horizons, we can think of oceans and mountains as things we cross. As David points out, though, now it's indissociable from the idea of border, wall, barbed wire, lookout stations. So I think this is what his work is what he's working with in his poetry, and it's like I say, I think we can all learn from it as Americans, especially where this ethnocentricity, superpower is informs all American poetry. However much it's invested in identity politics, behind it all is superpower. That said, let me repeat something I've said before, and I've said it here. When I first met Ralph Maud in Gloucester over 20 years ago, he said to me, if you pursue the study of Olson, you're going to meet a lot of good people. That prophecy was exact. I don't ever expect to hear a prophecy that rings as true as that. I personally have made the acquaintance of a lot of good people in the course of pursuing the study of Olson. Some of them have become good friends. I don't pretend to understand why. I can't explain it. But I am looking to David here to help shed some further light on that matter. Thank you. Please join me in welcoming David.
Wow. Thank you very much, Andre. I really appreciate that. A thing that is completely true, that was all true. But the really true thing that you said there, from my point of view, is that Olson really does strike me as a resource. So that's the way in which I approach the writing. And I don't know how that will sound here. I'm not always nervous, but I'm nervous being in Gloucester talking about Olson in this company. So we'll get that over and done with. So thank you for the introduction. Thank you to Henry and to everyone involved with the Gloucester Writers' Centre for allowing me to stay here. So Henry tells me that Vincent Farini wrote 30 volumes of poetry in this space. And as someone who's been here for like 5 days, you can feel it in the walls and in the carpet, and everything is bringing you into writing. So it's an extraordinary space to be. And I've also been using the Maud Olson Library, which is really a treat. I knew Ralph. I met Ralph in 2010 at the Vancouver conference, and then he came over and keynoted at the conference we held in Kent, and he came back two or three times. I still have faxes from Ralph. I don't know if other people fax with Ralph. It was tricky. It was like I wanted to email, but that was never going to happen. So it's really an honor to be here. By way of preamble, I just want to tell you what I've just come from. So until last Wednesday, I was I'm the organizer, as Andre said, of a project called Refugee Tales. One of the organizers, Refugee Tales, is a walk in solidarity with refugees asylum seekers and detainees. And every year for the past 4 years, we've walked across a tract of southern England for like 5, 6, 7 days at a time. And as we go, we have told the stories of people who have been held in indefinite detention in the UK. And I'm going to be talking about that just a little bit by way of preamble to the talk itself. The project is modelled on the Canterbury Tales insofar as it has an English model. We walk and we tell stories. Okay, it's really simple. We're informing people. We're also reclaiming the space for a better language. At least that's what we're trying to do. But the project is also an open field project. There is absolutely no question in my mind that this is kind of an active open field project. It's recognizing space and the importance of space, and it's recognizing the many different voices that are intersecting in that space. This makes me think that the Canterbury Tales was maybe the first open field poem. I noticed that the Canterbury Tales is on Olson's shelves, although I don't know I don't know how important it was to him. So the talk that follows is like a glimpse of a book project that I'm writing at the moment, which is reflecting on what I think I have learned from the Refugee Tales project, and it's talking about the book is talking about non-personhood, personhood, and movement, and the basic argument of the book is that we have to go back to understand where those discourses that we are now dealing with came from, and I am convinced that the moment that we have to go back to is exactly 1950, or as I say, 1948 to 1958, and we have to get back to that discourse, and Olson is one of the people that we definitely need to get back to. So the talk starts elsewhere, but it comes definitely to Olson. After I've given the talk, with permission, I'm going to slip into a different persona and read a poem, okay, which is called Feedback. So there we go. It's precisely on that feedback loop. So the talk is called Making Space for the Human. And its impulse in relation to Olson is out of Ed Dorn's claim that Olson's work, quote, anticipates a millennium already underway in 1950, which I believe. Okay, so the aim of this talk is to do a little mapping. In particular, what I hope to help map are two interlocking periods. The first period is our own, or that which stretches into our own, which is to say the 70-year period 1948 to the present. 1948 was the year the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was published, an event which is here taken to have an inaugural quality. It's the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, not much noticed, I would say, in the UK or elsewhere. In addressing this 70-year stretch, the argument cuts both ways. From the vantage of 2018, it is suggested, it is possible to define the period which it was anticipated in 1948 we were starting to live through. The second period on which the talk will actually focus is the decade 1948 to 1958, the argument being that to understand certain dynamics of the present moment, we need better to register what in the decade following the publication of the Declaration, writers were starting to set out to map. What the Universal Declaration set out to achieve was an image of the human from which no individual might find themselves excluded. We could have many conversations about what actually the Declaration consisted of and achieved, but there's a statement of its intention. Understood as cartography, which I think it has to be since it is bound up with territory, the intention was to provide a map whose contours were concepts and on which all persons would be entitled to appear. The person, as it appears in the Universal Declaration, is a legal category, a category intended to establish status in relation to the law. Motivated by the crimes of the Second World War, the purpose of the document was to ensure a correspondence between people and persons, such that in no circumstance should people again become non-persons. In its ambition, it was prophetic in that the legal non-person can be taken to be the contemporary period's defining figure. That's my sort of gambit. The point about the non-person, as far as cartography is concerned, is that they don't appear on any map. They are present, of course, but insofar as they are registered, it is in terms of absence. Rendered marginal to territory and occupying a range of extraterritorial places, the categories that shape their status are deportability and detainability. And just to break for a second, a reason that people who live where I live are involved and interested in this issue is that until recently, until 2016, there was an immigration removal centre, the Dover Immigration Removal Centre, sited on Dover's White Cliffs. So if you were getting the boat over from France and you knew that it was there, it was occupying the space of a fort. There was a fort in the Napoleonic period. So it was the most extraordinarily hostile gesture towards anybody who was coming in. And it was a kind of as an extraordinary place with an extraordinary significance in its own way. If we take detainability as the indicator, in 1973 in the UK, 95 people were indefinitely detained under immigration rules. By 1988, that number stood at 2,166. In 2017, according to Home Office statistics, just under 30,000 people were detained indefinitely without charge in the UK. Detention can be for days and weeks, not always for a long time, but it can be for months and years. The longest period of detention, arbitrary, without charge, was 9 years in the UK. Okay, these are significant and shocking statistics, and they take us right back to that moment that the Universal Declaration is addressing. It might be noted then that this form of detention, UK is the only country in Europe that detained in this way, is expressly counter to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, where Article 9 says, as one would expect, no one shall be subjected to arbitrary arrest, detention, or exile. So my point is just to observe that we're slipping, okay? And I know that we're in the UK, we're not the only people who are slipping. Such growth is mirrored elsewhere, notably in Anglophone jurisdictions. So in the US, for instance, the daily, not annual, detention population increased from 2,200 in 1985 to 33,400 in 2008, and I expect it's going up. In which year, in that year, 2008, the total number of people detained without charge under immigration rules was 378,582. A similar line can be drawn in the case of Australia, which, as people will be aware, externalises the process by the practice of offshoring, and where detention is mandatory for all non-citizens without a valid visa. There is a separate lecture to be given on the development of detention as a liberal democratic strategy for the construction of non-personhood. The claim here is simply that the attempt through the period 1948 to 58 to formulate a cartography on which all people might be present as persons appears now more urgent than ever. And that therefore it is helpful to understand what the discourse underpinning that map implied. So, part two, spatializing the language. In their composition, motives, political and legal implications, inheritance, operation and acts of omission, the 30 articles and preamble that constitute the Universal Declaration have been subject to extensive scrutiny. Naturally enough, given the claims the document makes towards the human, some of that scrutiny has sometimes taken the form of literary criticism, the intention being to situate the Declaration's thinking in the wider context of literary discourse. So there are two prominent examples worth mentioning. You might be aware of them. The first is Joseph Slaughter's Human Rights, Inc., The World Novel, Narrative Form and International Law. And the second, Mark Greif's The Age of the Crisis of Man, Thought and Fiction in America, 33 to 73. Both important books. For Slaughter, the Declaration's idea of the human is identifiable in the document's emphasis on the development of the human personality, a concept it drew from the tradition of the Bildungsroman, as Slaughter argues pretty compellingly, and from contemporary versions of which genre it has continued to gain legitimacy. So the idea of the human in the Universal Declaration, as Slaughter sees it, is modelled on that notion of the development of the personality you see in the Bildungsroman. For Greif, the Declaration was not inaugural, as is argued, as I would argue, but one of a series of mid-century texts which set out in the face of political catastrophe to define the category of human or man, as he notes, as a way of securing its value. What follows in Slaughter is an account of the Declaration that entrenches its conservative tendency, the individual seeking acceptance from the culture or the state. The individual goes to the culture for acceptance in the way that the hero in the Bildungsroman goes to the culture. For Greif, the document is driven by a totalizing tendency and should be discounted on the grounds of its ambition to define an essential quality. The counterargument, my counterargument here, is threefold. First, that such analyses of the Declaration, prominent as they are insufficient in their consideration of mapping, and especially they are insufficiently attentive to questions of space and spatial orientation. Second, that one key reason they lack a spatial aspect is that they default to the novel as a literary analogue to the Declaration, failing to register more exploratory cultural forms. I've got no beef with the novel, okay? But I am saying that there is a kind of reading of this Declaration that comes out that doesn't have to come out. It's because they fixate there. And third, most pressingly, that in failing to draw out the spatial character of the Declaration, such critical discourses fail to register its residual political force. What follows from these objections is an argument for a different kind of relation between the Declaration and contemporary literature. Rather than seeking its analogue in contemporary fiction, we need rather to read a cluster of texts in combination with one another, the text in question being, as I'm suggesting, the Universal Declaration itself, Charles Olson's works of the period, 1948 to 1958, starting in 1950, crucially with Projective Verse, Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism and the Human Condition, with particular reference to the essay The Perplexities of the Rights of Man, and, although I won't be talking about him here, Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth. In asserting the need to read these texts in relation to one another, I don't mean to indicate any clear intellectual priority, but rather that what one finds is a set of imaginations working at a manifestly pressing complex of issues and arriving at mutually illuminating terms. The complex of issues, as Arendt well understood, was fundamentally spatial in character. What the Second World War had brought unignorably into view was the category of the non-person, where that status was determined by two kinds of relation to space. The first was the camp, the brutalizing non-space in which such status was established. As Arendt observed, the camp as negative space was a principal legacy of the war, so much so that, as she observed, quote, the internment camp prior to the Second World War, the exception rather than the rule for the stateless, became the routine solution for the problem of domicile of the displaced persons. And so this is part of the value of going back to this discourse, is we get accounts of what we are observing right now as a matter of routine. The second interconnected relation to space was more obviously cartographic, consisting in the deeply compromised capacity for movement experienced by people who had fallen outside the category of persons. The minute you fall outside of that category, then what defines being outside of that category is a deeply thwarted, compromised capacity to move. That Olson also operated with such spatial poles in mind can be variously demonstrated, as people will appreciate. But as an initial indicator of the degree to which the spatial realities of the non-person informed the background to his thinking, one could consider his work at the Office of War Information. As Greif observes, the presence at the OWI of German nationals employed to translate propaganda made that department a crucial site of intellectual exchange, with American writers gaining a very early understanding of the nature of the camps. Greif points to Dwight MacDonald's article for Politics in 1945 as evidence of the transmission of information, but one might equally, and I think more profitably, point to Olson's startling essay, The Resistance, with its attempt to rehouse man in his body, quote, this house that moves, breathes, acts. The Greif book is very interesting, but it's a matter of deep frustration to me that he trawls through this whole period. And Olson, he finally remembers that he ought to mention Olson in the last couple of pages. And then it's very cursory, and I don't really think he's read him. I think he's read somebody who's read him. And it seems to me the most extraordinary oversight that Olson isn't part of this dialogue. Where the spatial implications of non-personhood bear most pressingly on the expression of the Universal Declaration is in Article 6, where, as it is said, quote, everyone has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. I think it's like sort of the pithiest of all the articles in that declaration. Rhetorically speaking, the article makes a significant double gesture, simultaneously lifting the individual from the confines of non-personhood, which is to say the camp, whether the concentration camp or, as Arendt is considering, the internment camp, by the insistence on a legal status that in the same moment grants their circulation everywhere. It's a good statement. Okay, there are not all of the articles have that clarity of expression. It is a form of expression that has a direct echo in Olson's own inaugural document, projective verse. That manifesto's concern with space is, of course, front and center. This is the inception of open field poetics, after all. The term that carries over from the declaration, however, is recognition. As Olson contests, a whole new series of recognitions is necessary from projective verse, where recognition specifies not only a given instance of attention within the work, but, crucially, the process of writing itself. So as he also says, at every given moment of composition, brackets, recognition, we can call it. Composition and recognition at this moment in his thinking, in projective verse, are synonymous, just at that moment. It is a gesture one finds in Arendt also, of course, notably in The Human Condition, where it is in the concept and political practice of the space of appearance that the negative spaces of non-personhood find their alternative. So to summarize this far, to read these texts in intersection is to notice first a significant shared rhetoric between projective verse and the Universal Declaration, the discourse of recognition. It is also, however, to gain insight in reverse, because I don't want this only to be the declaration reading Olson. To read the declaration not in the context of the fiction of the period, but in relation to its major poetic statement, which in some contexts might be controversial, but I'm guessing we get away with that right now, which is projective verse, is to recover the degree to which the declaration intends to be a statement regarding space. What Olson and Arendt allow one to register is that whereas in one sense the individual is plainly central to the logic of the Universal Declaration, what shapes it equally is the fundamentally spatial objective of arriving at an articulation of human settings from which no person might become excluded. The guiding impulse, in other words, is towards a spatialized articulation of the category of the human, where the issue is not the development of personality through time, nor its preservation against time, but a map of settings, call it a field, from which nobody might fall. So, next section, towards a space of recognition. To go back to the period 1948 to 1958, is to find descriptions of the problematics of political space, which, as they arise from the reading of the situation of the non-person, prove unerringly accurate as depictions of the present time. And my whole point is that we've walked into this situation where we are again detaining and deporting as a matter of routine, and again producing non-persons on a kind of industrial and post-industrial scale. But we don't, at the same time, have a language which is really trying to comprehend what this means, either from the point of view of the individual human or in a larger sense, not fully. So this is the reason that we do well to go back. So as Arendt reported in 1949, assessing the new conditions of human movement, what is unprecedented is not the loss of a home, but the impossibility of finding a new one. Suddenly, there was no place on earth where migrants could go without the severest restriction, no country where they could be assimilated, no territory where they could find a community. Okay, it's a truth now. It is because such a political cartography was then just becoming visible that the post-war discourse of space, the way in that discourse spaces were framed and related, warrants reconsideration. Broadly speaking, three kinds of spatial framing emerge. In the first place, one finds a discourse that engages seriously with the human consequences of non-space, which I think we badly need. There is no time to explore that aspect of the discourse here, but suffice to say that as the category of the non-person comes to the fore in contemporary politics, we urgently need to recover a language, provided by Arendt not least, which gauges the human cost of extraterritorial expulsion. A second kind of understanding arises from the concerted effort to frame a new political space, a setting whose ambition is to preclude non-personhood and which is therefore informed by the practice of recognition. A final kind of understanding, as will be touched on, I'll touch on in the conclusion, lies in the serious attempt to think through the question of scale, a mapping in which movement across and between communities might be possible. To dwell for a moment on the second kind of understanding, simply to name recognition as an aspiration, as the declaration does, is obviously hardly sufficient. Arendt's critique of the Declaration, and in particular its failure to address the realities of the nation's state system, is founded in this political fact. Equally, however, as both Arendt and Olson saw it, recognition was a necessary political objective. What was required, in other words, was not a naming or a call, but an articulation of recognition as a mode of thought and action, which is to say, a praxis. It was towards such a mode that Olson wrote Projective Verse. As he put it, every element must be taken up, you'll be familiar, but I'll read it anyway. Every element must be taken up as participants in the kinetic of the poem, just as solidly as we are accustomed to take what we call the objects of reality. The objects which occur at every given moment of composition, or recognition we can call it, must be treated exactly as they do occur therein and not by any ideas or preconceptions from outside the poem. What Olson presents in Projective Verse is something like a technology of recognition, the operating principle of which is that everything present will be solidly taken up. Nothing is to be considered as coming from outside the poem. Instead, we have the cognitive equivalent of the medieval principle that Arendt refers to in The Origins of Totalitarianism, which is quid est, I'm no Latinist, forgive me, quid est in territorio est de territorio. That which is in the territory is of the territory. It's a crucial recapitulation of that principle. What Olson proposes, in other words, which Arendt also argues for, is a space of relation in which every element is registered as participant in the whole. Desirable or necessary as this sounds, one can clearly argue that all it amounts to is a further instance of naming, an elaboration of the Declaration's call for recognition everywhere, graphically set out in the terms of the open field poem. What is required for such articulations of space to be understood as political is an account of method, where method would be an indication of how recognition is achieved. In fact, both Olson and Arendt were keen elaborators of method. Olson in particular, of course. Witness Olson's repeated promptings in Projective Verse. This feels wrong in an English accent, especially here, but here we go. Keep moving, like someone else should say this. Keep moving, speed in, speed the nerves, the perceptions, the acts, keep it moving as fast as you can, citizen. And if you also set up as a poet, use the process at all points in any given poem, always one perception must move instanter on another. Olson is hectoring, and his principal objective is to trigger an innovation in poetics. We should not be distracted from the fact, however, that as well as the poet, he addresses the citizen, the exacting method he proposes having a function in the political space he is looking to craft. It is a methodological exaction one finds echoed in Arendt, where the requirement constantly to reshape is asserted through the principle of what she calls natality. As she argued in The Human Condition, labour and work, as well as action, are rooted in natality insofar as they have the task to provide and preserve the world for, to foresee and reckon with, the constant influx of newcomers who are born into the world as strangers. That's Arendt. Given the context I'm invoking, the value of natality should be clear. Arendt, against a political geography constructed to produce the non-person, Arendt proposes a principle of action grounded in the fact and value of the newcomer, with natality, as she saw it, being the central category of political thought. Her quote. What matters in natality, however, is not simply the value that it ascribes to the stranger, but the link it has with work and action, and therefore the image of a political setting it enables Arendt to craft. Arendt and Olson arrived at the same term, as we know, for that setting, each alighting on the Greek term polis. Emerging from the war with a commitment to a space of recognition, both writers understood that such recognition could not be taken to be either given or granted as the declaration implied. I'll say that again. Emerging from the war with a commitment to space, to a space of recognition, both writers understood that such recognition could not be taken to be either given or granted, as the declaration implied, with each therefore undertaking to model a political space, the central dynamic of which was the action of providing for the influx of the newcomer and the strange. In each case, in the human condition and in the Maximus poems, where the method partly settled was in a meticulous presentation of the category of the work required to accomplish a political setting in which natality is understood as key. In one way, surely, this is disappointing. The last thing, after all, one wants as a method, you're waiting for your method, and what you get is a detailed requirement for work. One would hope for something more formally clear-cut, something as decisively binding as a declaration. In reading Olsen and Arendt in relation to the declaration, what one registers in that document is its orientation towards political space, with each writer, as they draw out its spatial implications, emphasizing the categories of action and work. There are many ways that one might develop this point, but perhaps the crucial point, I think, is to simply observe it as intellectual historical fact, that as Olsen and Arendt actually articulated the human not as quality or essence, but as a spatial relation, so the way they corrected the discourse of rights was in the intensity of agency that they described. It is a fact that we could direct in two ways. As it speaks to the present moment, it is a reminder of the scale of the undertaking necessary if the neoliberal production of non-persons through acts of expulsion is to be resisted. It's going to take a lot of work. I think that's a really straightforward but really true observation. And we really lost. So Andre referred. That was actually my sentence from that chat. It wasn't Miriam's sentence. That particular sentence was mine. And insofar as we stopped thinking about a thing that Olsen was encouraging us to think about, work seems really crucial, because work is where agency is. And if it's a thing that we lost in the intervening period, and now we're suffering the catastrophe of losing that, then surely it's work and the agency that that implies. Within the context of the Olsen-Arendt discourse itself, the question was how this image of a political setting connected to the larger cartographical question of human movement. Arendt's contention on this front was that the polis existed wherever people gathered. This is the thing that she says in The Human Condition. The question is what this might mean or might have meant in practice. Right, last part before the poem. So the last part, the question of scale. If one frames the Universal Declaration in terms of the development of a certain kind of personality, then as a document for political progress, it has limited use. If one's starting point, however, is not personality but space, and if the driving concern is taken to be the alarming production through expulsion of non-persons, then more than ever, it would seem, one needs the aspiration of a linguistic map from which no person might fall. Badly. We need that map badly. The argument here is that for all that they departed from aspects of the Declaration's thinking, Olsen and Arendt wrote from within that guiding objective. Even to state that objective is, of course, to run up against the principal technology of expulsion being, as Thomas Nail brilliantly details, the border. Equally, it was a crucial aspect of their thinking that as they developed the implications of the declaration, both Olsen and Arendt addressed themselves to the border as fact. In Olsen, that address could hardly be more deliberate, and I felt so much more conscious of this opening line being here. Maximus opening his poetic address from offshore by islands. One finds the same concern in the kinetics articulated in projective verse, with its insistence on movement through and across. In the presentation of topography, that in its extraterritorial movement, Jeremy Prynne, the British poet, identified as the poetry's curve in the brilliant lecture that he gave in Vancouver following Olsen's death. And most graphically, of course, on the cover of Maximus 4, 5 and 6, where the projection of Guadalanand is a reminder of the possibility of movement movement across. In Arendt, one hears the border theorized extensively in her articulation of the trinity of state, people, territory, from which those rendered non-persons find themselves expelled. If you're outside that trinity, then you are expelled and then you can't move, as Arendt observes. In both writers, in other words, one finds a mapping deeply acquainted with the violence of the nation state. In both writers, however, it is possible also to discern the outline of a different kind of map. In part, this is to observe that each articulates a model of what we might term, by contrast with the state, civil society. Against the border, but also across its exclusions, Arendt and Olson model forms of agency that can secure and extend spaces of recognition. The work involved in developing such settings is intense, and even then it is hardly enough. But since the alternative is the normalization of spaces which produce non-persons, it is hardly possible also to desist. An actual map of such settings would be patchy. So if you like were to map the spaces where the production of non-persons was being resisted, it would be a patchy map. And as both writers understood, there remained a profound problem of scale. How do you get from the polis to the scale of movement that it is you're trying to address? There is, however, another more extensive mapping provided by Arendt at the end of The Perplexities of Human Rights, which is the it's the essay she writes in 1949 that gets absorbed into Origins of Totalitarianism, which roots us back through the category of work. The great danger, she argues, at the end of that essay arises from, quote, the existence of people forced to live outside the common world. The great danger is that, for those people, is that they lack the tremendous equalizing of differences which come from being citizens of some commonwealth, since they are no longer allowed to partake in the human artifice. In the UK, people seeking asylum are forbidden to work. It is key to the way their non-personhood is constructed. For as long as their cases are pending, where pending can mean well over a decade, two decades. If there's a form of torture which falls outside of general understandings of torture, then precluding a person from the social interaction of work is a form of torture. It destroys people. Frantz Fanon is really useful here in describing what actually happens when people internalize the space and the relations that are being imposed upon them. It is the oldest form of expulsion where pending can we, well, sorry, it is the oldest form of expulsion. The person seeking asylum is expelled or re-expelled from the commons, compelled in their non-personhood to live outside. Re-establishing such a commons is no small undertaking, but it helps at least to recover the outline of the map. Everybody, as Article 23 of the Declaration states, has the right to work, through which transitional demand for making, which is also to say poesis, Olson and Arendt observe a mapping of recognition that is possible. Thank you. And subtle change of costume, indiscernible to anyone in the room. A poem, which is a sequence, 9 poems, which is trying really hard to contemplate some of these questions. It's called Feedback, and it's from this volume Through. And I was really happy going back to, I think it's in Mayan Letters or Human Universe, where Olson dwells on throughness as a consideration, which I had forgotten, but I'm sure I hadn't forgotten when it was coming up with this. So this is Feedback. 1. We are not done. After the April we had, and the August, and the January, rain cleaned down against the dooryard steps, setting out the way that architecture separates things, places, persons, trees, bread. The way the documents stack up, out with the space set by to read them, think how short time thou hast abiden here, airports, certain outskirts of our cities, after the process, the way the judgments foreclose, after the December, and all the elements left lying around us, when the winds blow and the seas whose steadfast faith yet never moved, process, no change of rule, only the direction of governance, persons disregarded, after the borders closed. After the process, after the wreckage in transmission, the rain, the repetition, the world without end, in the streets, we are not done. This is unfinished business, outside standing, constructing space. 2. This much we can say. Insistence is part of the argument, coming back to a person's bearing, the way a body rests, notwithstanding the story. Was never man so like among us? Separate. I don't believe it, that chit, chit, chat. Part of the argument, the dooryard echoes in winter, so the sound passes through of somebody else's emergency, abiding here, restricted in every particular. It was on the following day, he fell from grace. Within a budding grove, a person designated uninvited, j'ai eu pitié des autres, probablement assez. I don't think so, hardly enough, so like my life while it will last, the principle, elements, shorn from context. And somewhere we might stand to contemplate an open environment. I learned something recently, that we lack tact at our airports, certain part of the argument, talking simply, face to face. 3. Then there is the question of measure, continuously monitoring and modelling, in which circumstance I want to specify blood and bone, gesture, motion, aught else the world can offer. A woman in the garden sings a cradle song. Trending, a plane goes down. Maybe if we sift the fragments, locked down on the skyline, scarcely credible on such a scale, our all we have, held together by spit and syntax, moments in the protest when affection yields. Discourse, I think we should sue today for no compassion, since these practices among us have functioned long enough. Break open the argument, the story that shuts up our territory. Bodies governed outside the scope of law. Subject to change. I get a call about Dover, and in the garden the lady singing gets our reports to match. Sirens, cigarettes. She is a credible witness. Subject to process. The sun kicks back. 4. This is a song for lovers. The wreckage is part of the urgency. You send me today. Text me a scrap of life. Exact words. Therefore simply does what is to be done. Last thing. Put some kind of document together. Something we can trade on. The history of a conversation broken only by the moments the networks went down as we talked, getting most things wrong. Except perhaps the deep are done here. Last thing. To exercise your faculties at large. I live at the foot of a hill, look out over an ancient city. At 3 in the morning, the traffic stops, leaving only sirens the way things go, echoing gracelessly as we go. At 4, birdsong. At 6, start up, and all the while, process, gesture, motion, until his action is a reality long, long we sing by rote, shaping to intervene. This is a song for lovers, and aught else the world can show. 5. And the truth is, there aren't many images. February, the news breaks, the snow won't last. In the hoarfrost, we contemplate obscure attachments, sleep pattern, broken, future, indefinite, and the realization for like the millionth time, there is no context for the argument to be put, which we should make, only a person presenting disparate attributes, notwithstanding, a song thrush nails the neighborhood into place. And not for the first time, though this is snow in February, and where the letter finishes, it doesn't say who wrote, only the way things go, which is somebody's emergency, aggression rendered in its most intimate form, with only the process laid out. The laying out is part of the process. I lay this out. I had to learn the simplest things last, and I am writing to say that the buck stops where I stop, and the snow melts, and the context falls into place. 6. Today is pale. I'd like to make an intervention now, please. Across the city, the traffic never stops. When the winds blow and the seas and the small rain arbitrates, the process and the waiting continues and the watching, I'd like to interrupt. From rupture to break, I record that a person's bearing is not now constitutional in a court of law, that the emergency is this, the last book of songs and airs, where we have wandered all our ways, the which on earth do spring, through cowslips and kingcups at certain outskirts of our cities, clustered in bedless houses whereby the franchise stops, bordered, held at bay, not granted access to the currency. Bid her, therefore herself, soon ready make. Bid her, herself soon make, out of the fragments we left lying around us. Fragmentation is part of the process, turning things out. This is a song for lovers, gathering, arbitrating, proposing tact. 7. This is the object, to constitute a modern document. Put the pieces together in the open, the way the days fall out. You call after you make your report. Reporting is part of the process. And the rain is, and the way the blackbird. You contemplate questions I decline to ask. Even such is time. The object is to constitute a context. Where I live is the house's back towards an ancient church, where Ethelbert married Bertha. This is not my position. Questions not possible to formulate before a court of law. Even such is time. Even such is time, finding herself not 20 miles north of Dover, where the language stops and the jurisdiction they call the building St. Martin's of Tours, a kind of welcome, a kind of gesture out, even where the language, such is my position, where the open, where the lilac falters, where a contemporary standing, a contemporary stops, a welcome of sorts. We live in a pay-as-you-go environment, and the contract is part of the process, and I'm worried one day the calls will stop. Such is time, even such is time. You call from outside the currency, and the rain is, and the report, March 7th, 12 o'clock. And the reality is, the process doesn't hesitate. In the garden, a cat rips open a garbage bag as the forsythia starts to show, which I can name now since somebody told me, in thick, blocky passages. So the way of a way of reckoning unfolds. And the way I reckon it, we should open with the untranslated, born, as I doubt, to all our dole, with the mourning in place, since all was not unbeautiful, suddenly holding an emergency at bay. Suddenly, herewith, out with the politics notwithstanding, for none can call again the passive time, you stop, you do nothing wrong. I'd like to improvise a context, wherewith, somewhere where with lilac, camped in conversation, where the dogwood lies, here maybe, maybe herewith. Sometimes the practice was outsourced to other territories. We look on, we improvise the simplest things last, as the winds blow and the seas and the prospect starts again out of nothing, as the dew starts, as the papers circulate, making it up as you go along. 9. As you go, as the seas, as you stepped over the threshold, as the winds as the traffic, as the emergency stops, as you wait as nothing happens, as you passed out of the currency, as the letter as, after the process, after the aircraft drops. As the contract came good, as a still more intimate model, as without restriction, everything is lawful now, as the dew falleth on the grass, as they pay you a deep attention, not even a compliment, as you go about your business, as for whomever inhabited it, as the story breaks. As the process sets out, as the framework sequences arbitrarily, as you came from the holy land of a broken state, sirens, cigarettes, as the small rain graced the language, out with, notwithstanding, as you spoke, we showed up late. Thank you.